This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. 1963 was a pivotal year in the American Civil Rights Movement.
I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
North Carolina and its people have come to the point of recognizing the urgent need for opening new economic opportunities for Negro citizens. And we also recognize that in doing so, we shall be adding new economic growth for everybody.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Three voices, all in 1963, Alabama Governor George Wallace, North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech in Washington in August of that year. That same month, five black students walked onto the campus of Duke University. They were Mary Mitchell Harris, Jean Kendall, Wilhelmina Rubin Cook, Cassandra Smith Rush, and Nathaniel White Jr. Duke is commemorating the 50th anniversary of its integration all this year with a series of events, and we're taking a look back this hour at that moment 50 years ago at Duke and the long road to acceptance and full equality for black students on the campus. And we're starting with one of the men who crossed the color barrier at Duke back in 1963. Nat White Jr. grew up in Durham, graduated from Duke, served in a number of roles, including president of the Hayti Development Corporation. Nat White Jr., welcome to State of Things.
Good. It's good to be here. Thanks.
Take us back to 1963, that time when you first started as a student at Duke. What was it like walking on that campus for you?
Well, it was a very interesting experience from a number of different angles. One thing that sort of ties to the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech is that I attended that rally with family members. We really had a family reunion there. So the North Carolina wing, the D.C. wing, and the New York wing of the White Klan met at the March on Washington, and 3 weeks later I was entering Duke. To do it, however, it meant moving 4 miles from where I had lived on Austin Avenue and attended Hillside, going to an entirely different world that I had experienced prior.
Yeah, tell us more about that. You did grow up in Durham. As you said, you went to Hillside. Did you ever think that you'd be going to Duke? When did it occur to you that's a possibility?
I actually had no interest in going to Duke. I was a Hampton Pirate primarily because that's where my father and uncle went, and I'd gone to enough homecomings and graduations to think that I was going there as well, and I had a full scholarship there.
What turned it for you? Yeah, how did then you come to go to Duke in that important year, 1963?
It was actually the counselor at our school, Edith King, sort of recruited, quote unquote, the top academic male and female in our class, and Mary Mitchell Harris and I were encouraged to apply. And Mary actually wanted to go to Duke because her mother had worked there for a time. And she and I were uniquely connected because we attended first grade at Burton Elementary School together and attended school all the way through Duke.
How was Duke perceived in the African-American community at that time?
Well, I think it was an unknown quantity. Except for the fact that there were people who worked there, and it certainly was a segregated environment. I don't think people knew exactly what to expect. There was one experience that we had at Hillside. There was a science seminar that occurred every Wednesday night at Durham High, and 10 of us from Hillside went to Durham High to learn science. And so that was kind of a prelude to what it might be, though that in itself was different from my experiences in that the entire 4 years I was at Duke, there was not a single other black student in any of my classes.
Well, an unknown quantity in terms of what it might like to be like to be in the classroom. But in terms of Duke's relationship with Durham, especially black communities in Durham, that was certainly something. Duke did have something of a reputation among black people in Durham, no?
That is true. And I think the people who knew most about that were those who lived closest to the campus and also who worked on the campus. I did not live close to it and, in fact, had no real – I think Duke was an image from the sports teams. There were, of course, the university and the – I mean, then the hospital. But for myself – other than it was a school that had not yet integrated, there wasn't my relationship to it was I almost had no relationship to it, in fact.
How did you get along with the other four black students at Duke? As you said, there were no other black students in your classes, right?
That's correct. But we were, in a sense, bonded together in very unique ways, and we went to sporting events and to other events together and had a relationship of all being in it together, in a sense. And for most of us, kept up with each other, although two of us have passed. And Mary and I reconnected in Atlanta years later in 1992. And it was sort of ironic that we lived about as far from each other in Atlanta as we had in Durham.
You were in that first class of undergrads to integrate Duke. Dr. Brenda Armstrong came to Duke in the third class of African-American students. She would go on to organize the takeover of the Allen Administration Building in 1969, graduated from Duke in 1970, and went on to become a pediatric cardiologist. She's now a physician and administrator at Duke Medical Center and with us today, Dr. Brenda Armstrong. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us about your first days at Duke.
Well, it was something of a culture shock. I came from rural eastern North Carolina. I went to Booker T. Washington High School, segregated high school. And interestingly enough, where I came from, Rocky Mount, was a different place. The only time I saw white people was with my mom, who clutched my hand as if something terrible was going to happen to me. And my father and uncles were all accomplished people beyond what would have been expected. My dad was a physician. My uncle was in the last class at Leonard Medical School at Shaw. One of my uncles was trained at Howard and was a pharmacist who compounded all the medicines. But what they had in common was the sense of give back to the community. And so they didn't care that their patients couldn't pay. They basically took care of people because there was nowhere else to go. They made the decision for me to go to Duke.
And forgive me for interrupting, but I read that you had the opportunity to go to a private school rather than the segregated school in Rocky Mount, a private academy in New England.
Yeah, and the Dana Hall School.
Why did you choose, or did you choose? How did
we
the choice?
We chose not to go. My mom and dad left it up to my sister and me. I have a sister who's 9 months and 2 days apart from me, so we're like twins. And we decided that either both would go or neither would go. My sister wanted to go. I didn't want to go.
Why not?
I loved my school, despite the fact that we had very few resources. We had teachers who could see the future for us. They were trained well enough to teach in college, but there were no jobs. And so they were forbidden to teach us math above algebra. They were forbidden to do what we would think of now as AP courses, or else they would lose their jobs. So on Saturday, when it was their free time, they gave us that gift. And they were the ones that put Duke on the map and Harvard on the map and some other schools on the map. And my parents, because of the vengeance that was visited on them for being activist type people in the community were terrified that something would happen to me if I was so far away. So when the offers came, they chose Duke. And I was fine with it because I figured that they knew what was right for me. So I came to Duke, and when I looked around, there were 20 of us in my class. And of the 20, there were 5 women and 15 men. By the end of the first year, there were 10 of us left. And the social isolation, the educational isolation, some of the racism that was visited on us was remarkable, is not even the word. When I got a paper that I spent a lot of time working on back, and I got a D, and I knew my mom was an English literature person. I sent it to her, and she said, "Why did you get a D? It's an A-plus paper." And I said, well, I asked the professor, and he told me that I couldn't possibly have done that kind of work.
We're going to talk more about how you coped with that, where you found social support and a network to support you in those earliest days of Duke as an integrated university 50 years ago. Talking about that on the state of things with Dr. Brenda Armstrong, who came to the school a few years after Nat White Jr., who is also with us. He is one of the 5 students in the first class of African Americans at Duke. Coming up, we'll hear more about how black student that experience at Duke, how it evolved, and what else was going on among private universities in the Southeast. All of that on the State of Things. From North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Duke is commemorating the 50th anniversary of integration this year. There will be a series of special events on and off campus. One of the first black students at Duke was Nat White Jr., and he's with us, along with Dr. Brenda Armstrong, in the third class of African-American students with us here today. Nat White, you're among that first group, and you said there was very little support. What did you do? Where did you find support for some of the many needs you had, academic needs, social needs, all of that? Where did you find support?
Well, you know, fortunately for me, I was from Durham, so that made it quite easy to reconnect with parts of town where I had always been. I think the few of us that were on campus, and I think Brenda's right in terms of the kind of isolationism and then some of the incidents that happened, but the core of students that were there bound together, I think there were 5 in our class, 11 in the next class, and Brenda indicated there were 20 in hers. And so there were a core there. And I think the way that Duke had prepared for us specifically is that we were put in a dorm that was not all freshmen. In fact, it had all classes. And Gene Kendall and I, the other black student, he was in engineering track, were on the same floor with upperclassmen roommates. And so there was, you know, a certain kinship among the students that were there, but you know, pretty much in terms of the academic, we were pretty isolated.
And Brenda, there may not have been, forgive me, but I was going to ask Brenda this question. There may not have been many other black students and faculty certainly at Duke at the time. But
there were none.
But the staff, the housekeeping staff and secretaries, that's a different story. And you became very close with them.
Yes. One of the events that stands out in my mind was that the receptionist in our dormitory was one of the kindest people to everybody. But one of the things we found difficult was that students who were so much younger than her called her by her first name. She was in her late 30s, early 40s. And I remember distinctly saying, "Can you please tell me your last name?" And she did. And I said, "Is it okay if I call you Mrs.? Because someone calling you by your first name is like someone calling my mother by her first name." And it was upsetting enough to us that we asked our house mom if we could talk about it during a house meeting. And it blew my mind that someone would ask, "Well, why can't I call her by her first name? We have maids in my house." And I said, "Because my mom is her age. And if you called my mom by her first name, I'd be in your face, and I wouldn't be very nice about what I said to you. It's a form of respect. This woman has a family. She works every day. She deserves the same respect that you would give to a parent.
And they decided
to
call her by her last name and offer that respect. So it's this consciousness raising. I mean, Nat, imagine how disorienting it is for white students to realize now I'm sitting across from somebody who is an equal. They're in my classroom. They're no longer the daughter of a servant or someone mm-hmm. who's doing that work. What did you find in terms of your interactions with white students and how they were responding to you? What kinds of reactions were you getting on campus?
Well, I think there were various reactions. I do remember you take certain biases into the process, and this is everybody. And I had a certain bias, too, against Southern accents. and part of the reason was we had this world history class that was actually piped in from UNC-TV and into the auditorium at Hillside. Mm-hmm. And the professor or the teacher was so often saying nigra as he referred to Negroes. Mm-hmm. And so I sent him a little note saying, it might help you to know that the way to say the word is like KNEE.GROW. And what happened is he avoided ever using the word at all after that, rather than changing his pronunciation. And so one person I remember on my floor, and we had the first math class, which was calculus, was from Asheville and had a deep Southern accent. And I knew that he had had no experience with black students. And I think we both came into the situation with the bias. He's dumb as a lock to me because he has this deep Southern accent. And, of course, I'm black, and that could only be it. And actually, we became somewhat friends in that, challenged by the same course and getting through it. For me, fortunately, I'd had up to calculus at Hillside, and the first half of the course was a repeat. So I think when I got an A in the course and he got a B in the course, that helped him a bit.
So, Nat, you're in the first class. Brenda, you're in the third class. Then a few years later, Maureen Collins arrives on campus. She graduated in 1976. She's now the Director of Multicultural Resources at the Duke Medical Center and with us today. Welcome, Maureen. Good to have you.
Glad to be here.
So you've heard those stories. How similar or dissimilar was your experience when you got there a few years later?
Well, I was just thinking what a difference a few years make, and also thinking the more things change, the more they remain the same. So unlike Brenda and Nat, I went to Catholic schools K through 12 and first went to school with white students in the ninth grade. So high school was in Winston-Salem at an integrated high school, and we were one of the first classes to integrate that school. So I didn't think much about coming to Duke because I was tired of white people. It was such an awful experience mm-hmm. in high school. And like you, Ned, I was headed to Hampton. I was not going to Duke. But by the time I was ready to go to college, the predominantly white schools were hosting black student weekends and inviting students to come look at the schools. And they would party you and take you to a class and try to recruit you to their school. So Duke was one of the schools that that I went to visit. And I liked it, but I was going to Hampton. You know, I just wasn't going to school with white people anymore. And when I got back, I went into the high school principal's office, Sister Martin Anthony, to tell her that I had gone to this weekend. And she said to me, well, good for you, but there's no point in your applying to Duke University. You'll never get in. Now, I graduated first in the high school class. And so I applied. I got in. I sashayed into her office with my my acceptance and my scholarship.
Yeah.
And I had a full scholarship to Hampton as well. And she said, well, you can go, but you'll never graduate. And so that's how I ended up at Duke University.
That's all it takes.
That was all it takes.
You can't challenge from
do
a
it.
Nun.
You cannot you do it from a nun. Right?
Wow. Wow. And then what was the experience when you got there?
Well, I had the benefit of having more African-American students around me, but I lived in the dorm that was called the Graduate Center on Trent Drive. So it was a dormitory where the third floor were undergraduate women, the basement through second floor were graduate students. And so my roommate, Gloria, and I were the only African-Americans in the undergraduate population there. And it was a dormitory that was a little bit isolated from the campus. So it was, you know, we had each other, but it was, you know, kind of lonely. But we met the other black students early on, there was a wonderful meeting that the Association of African Students, the precursor to the BSA, held. And so we were oriented to the campus and began to make friends and relationships that way. So it was a little bit different in that regard.
I want to figure out where Duke stood in the grand scheme of things back then, starting in 63 when it desegregates. So to find that out, I want to talk with John Thielen. He's a professor of education at the University of Kentucky and the author of A History of American Higher Education. John Thielen, welcome to The State of Things.
Very good to be here, and particularly honored to join with the Duke alums.
Duke integrated in 63. What else was going on? Was this about the same time other Southern universities were integrating?
Very parallel with what I would call the other really academically prestigious private universities in the South. So I would, along with Duke, I would add Rice University in Houston, Emory in Atlanta, Tulane in New Orleans, and Vanderbilt in Nashville. And it's a very, very close range in terms of the timing. And by the way, I would use the term desegregation for these events because I would think of integration, given what the Duke alums have commented on, that none of these universities, at least in the initial years, had what I would call a complete welcoming and embrace into the life of the campus. So I see it more as desegregation. One thing I would notice is that the last part of a campus to desegregate usually would be the undergraduate college, and that usually would be preceded by some desegregation in professional and graduate schools. And that seems to be consistent across all these universities.
So Duke actually desegregated the law school and divinity school a couple years earlier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And did divinity school lead the way or not? Was that the case in some Southern universities where the div school was pressuring maybe the rest of the university, or was that not the case?
I think that's quite consistent, certainly at Vanderbilt and Emory. I don't believe Rice has a divinity school. Yes, they were, I think, the leaders, and they were also the conscience of the institution. Ironic that probably the most poorly funded professional schools lead the way.
Yeah. What was there a difference between the experience of desegregation in private universities versus public?
Interesting is that probably the private universities lagged behind because I think that in many states the mandate as a aftermath of Brown versus the Board of Education tended to refer first to public and state institutions. And that interesting enough is that for the prestigious private research universities, one of their explanations for lagging was they really wanted to be more concerned with high academic standing. Yet that excuse backfired because what they found from the Association of American Universities and from federal research agencies is that if they were not to break their racial barriers, they would be in jeopardy, one, to lose federal research funds, and two, to not be included in the ranks of the Association of American Universities. So there's some ironies in there.
Well, one of the you point out the distinction, and I think wisely, between integration and desegregation. The first step is to open the doors, but as Brenda, Maureen, and Nat have all said, it was anything but an integrated experience there. Brenda, that meant that you had to take some action, and in 1969 you did. You organized the takeover of the Allen administration building. What was going on there? What did you want to achieve?
Well, there were a number of social and academic issues that had been on the plate for 2.5 years. We organized the Afro-American Society in the spring of my freshman year. And one of the things that happened was we found each other quickly. We had very similar high school experiences. We were from similar high schools, and we were very, very academically gifted. And yet we were treated as if we were another class of citizens. We also had no access to any kind of social outlet at all. We didn't have cars. We got on the bus and went over to North Carolina Central. And the people who led us out of Duke socially were those very people who had been at Duke for years, serving, maintaining the university. And we didn't like the way they were treated. And then we saw that we were treated the same way. What brought us together initially was Duke's consistent allowance of social groups to use Hope Valley Country Club, which had an openly segregated membership clause. And so when we tried to talk to Douglas Knight about it, he didn't want to talk to us. So we sat in and studied until he came out of his office to talk to us about it. And then the university, of course, decided that it was not in their best interest to continue that. They should never have done that with us, because it showed to us that we could leverage what we knew and the people who were helping us grow outside of Duke, people like Ben Ruffin and Howard Fuller and Philip Cousins, who were the mainstays for the reality check for us. So very quickly, we identified a number of issues that we wanted the university to address. So we kept having these conversations, but nothing happened. And so actually, in the fall of 1969, we decided that we needed a more forceful demonstration. And so we planned the Allen Building takeover, and we did it by memorizing the floor plan, the every window, lock, transom of the first floor of the Allen Building, its schedule. And we did it like most people would think we would do it. We learned something and then went back and added to a diagram.
Now, interestingly enough, the president, the brand new president of the university at the time, was Terry Sanford.
No.
He was not president.
Douglas
then.
Knight was the president. Terry Sanford was the person who was brought in and appointed after Douglas Knight left. And I put it that way because none of us know whether he was fired or. But Terry Sanford was the person to get Duke out of it. I don't know any other way to say it.
Well, John Thielen, let me ask you what Terry Sanford's role is, because, you know, in 63, he's governor of North Carolina, and a guy named George Wallace is the governor of Alabama, two very different people. What's his role, and how important was it in the transformation of Duke?
I think that'd be an interesting dichotomy between the two governors. And I think from the from some of the tapes that you played early on, that Terry Sanford, I think, tried to position North Carolina as a state as being progressive, and it would, you know, in stark contrast, in Alabama, where George Wallace would be reactionary. And one difference between the states is that what's often overlooked, for example, is that the president of the University of Alabama, Frank Rose, was very much in opposition to George Wallace, but he lost out in a very stark political contest. So I think that Terry Sanford would then carry on that role as ambassador and diplomat and an agent of change.
Maureen Collins, let's talk about black faculty at Duke, because by then there were more black faculty members by the time you were there or not. How is it changing in the early 70s?
Not very many. There was a visiting faculty member from North Carolina Central, Dr. Thorpe in history, Dr. Bethay in, I don't remember if he was divinity or religion, and Dr. Cook had gone by that time, and there were a couple of other visiting faculty during the time. Ray Gavins was there also, Dr. Gavins in history. My whole time at the university, I never was taught by an African American or any other person of color for that matter. But we all knew them. You know, we were glad they were there, and everyone knew everyone, you know, by face and would meet them. So that wasn't part of my undergraduate experience.
Nat White, let me ask you, if you're in the vanguard in all of this, you start out with one of five students. There were more, but very few, even by the time you graduated. I mean, were there times along the way when you thought, look, I just can't do this, and you wanted to leave?
Oh, I don't think that. I think there were some experiences that I knew were related to who I was, separate from who the other students were. And in the classroom, one of those was a differential equations class that I had that required, and I can remember this as if it were yesterday. It had a midterm and a final, and unbelievably, even to me, I got 100 on the midterm. And on the in theory, there were 50-50. I got a 79 on the final. I remember I had 19 hours, and, you know, I'm doing my parsimony and deciding what I should do. So I'm thinking 89 and a half on a 60, 70, 80, 90 scale. Maybe he'll give me an A-. Well, in fact, I got a C. He changed the grading system to 60, 70, 80, 90 on the final only. And apparently, because he couldn't see me getting such a grade of either B+ or A-, that was the way it went. So I just think that and you knew that experiences like that were only due to who I was versus right. who he was. Now, the fact that his name was Heinrich might have had something to do with it. Who knows?
Well, we'll talk about how you all managed to endure and thrive and prosper and in some cases even come back to Duke as our conversation continues talking about the integration, desegregation of Duke University, a 50th anniversary. We will be back after a short break. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Duke University desegregated 50 years ago. The school is hosting a series of events throughout the year to commemorate the event. First is a reception this week at the Nasher Museum. That's already sold out. We're talking about integration and the black student experience at Duke with Nat White Jr., one of the first five black students to integrate the campus. He graduated in 1967. Dr. Brenda Armstrong, Duke Class of 70, now a physician and administrator at Duke Medical Center. Maureen Cullens, a graduate of Duke in 1976, now director of multicultural resources at the Duke Medical Center. And John Thielen's a professor of education at the University of Kentucky and author of A History of American Higher Education. And in the break, Brenda and Maureen are exchanging war stories, trying to top one another with the horror stories that occurred to them. Nat is off in our Chapel Hill studio. So, Maureen, what did you have to do to tell us about your strategy, I guess, for and why you developed a strategy for handing in your papers?
Well, I was just telling Brenda that in one of my anthropology classes, the professor announced that blacks and women couldn't do anthropology. And I was the only black student in the class, so I was terrified. And I spent the entire semester getting white students to turn in my papers, and I never went to spend any time with a TA in an effort not to be identified with the work that I turned in.
And did you notice you were getting better grades when white kids handed in your...
Well, I did it from the beginning, so I didn't have a basis of comparison.
Baseline. Well, let me start with you, Maureen, and then go around the table and ask you how you did it. How did you endure, and why didn't you quit?
Well, it wasn't impossible. I mean, I had, as I said, what I think of when I look back, a remarkable experience in my high school, which was we were among the first classes to integrate and was very racist despite the fact that it was a Catholic high school. So I had training, you know, before I came to Duke. But beyond that, we had all these folks around us who were going through it at the same time. And like Brenda, and I'm sure Nat before her, we were supported by the staff. So the women who were at the front desk were very kind to us, made sure we got up and out on time, took us home to dinner, to church or whatever. The wonderful women in the cafeteria made sure we ate every day. We could come in there late, and they'd shake their heads and say, here, give us plates, you know, mm-hmm. make sure that we ate. The folks in the library wanted to know why they hadn't seen us, where we were studying. Gloria and I had carols that they had found for us, and they expected to see us there studying. So we had lots of support, in addition to having friends, because there were a few more African-American students there mm-hmm. by the time I got to Duke.
And Brenda, just along the lines of the staff, you actually tell a story about that I think illustrates how deeply committed the staff were to your success. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you were trying to iron one day rather than study.
Yep. And, you know, Miss Mildred came in and said, you're supposed to be studying. Don't you have a test? And, you know, I felt like, oh, my God, my mom is here. I would never have quit. And the reason for me not to quit had to do with my family. And and the struggles that they had endured to get to where they were, and the fact that they never every day let me not forget that I was supposed to be better than they were. In the African-American community, each generation since slavery was to be better than the one that was before. And so they didn't, there was no way I wasn't going to do this. And I was so fortunate because I had been brought up to respect everybody. It didn't matter what their station in life was. And it came out so naturally with Miss Mildred that it shocked me, but it also made me understand that there was more work to be done. And that was one of the reasons why we formed the Afro-American Society. We identified some issues and we would not let up until somebody said, we're just not going to do this. Yeah. And that was when we took over the Allen Building.
As I was going to say, you did more than endure. You decided to push forward for full rights. And let me stick with you a second and ask you, what was the legacy then? What was the result of the Allen takeover?
You don't have enough time for me to tell you that when we took it over, we took over the Allen Building to save ourselves. We didn't realize that in the process we were saving everybody else who would come behind us. That we, it's funny, we had a conversation about when we were going to the building in the back of a truck, dark everywhere. And my best friend, who since died, held my hand and said, you're right. We have to do this. This is our middle passage. And she was right. And so we did it to regain our sense of self-worth. We did it to make sure that nobody else would be treated the way that we had been treated. And we did it so that we could get to the next level with our self-respect and dignity intact.
Nat White, I'm happy to let you answer that question as well, but I'm also curious about your relationship with the school after you graduated, given some of the difficulties you experienced.
Well, I think the thing that brought me back to the university was really the Duke University Black Alumni Connection and the fact that it offered an opportunity to try to help those students who were like me but who came after. And one of the things that we ended up doing during that early process was developing kind of a mentorship program for students. And I happened to be back in Durham then. I don't think I would have gravitated back had it not been for a way to sort of make the path better. I do think, too, the one of the reasons I was able to survive before we had the critical numbers that had a community that could sort of work through that fashion was really sort of like Brenda, my upbringing and training. I knew I was going to be a math major because my fourth grade teacher, Catherine Pratt, said, you know, you have a way with math. You ought to pursue that. And there was an attitude from there and from the teachers, and Brenda mentioned it before, how the teachers that we had were could really teach in college, but they didn't have those opportunities, and that was true at Hillside. My math teacher went to teach at Central later. The French teacher had studied at the Sorbonne, et cetera, et cetera. And they were basically telling us, you can and you will. So when you met obstacles later, you didn't let those get in your way.
You know, speaking of the Alumni Association that you just mentioned, Brandon tweeted us a second ago, and he wants to know what are some of the things that Black Duke alumni can do to hold the school accountable today in the way it supports blacks. I guess I'll start with you, Maureen.
That's a great question. I think those who are local, who live in the Triangle, can certainly help with the mentoring and providing opportunities for internships and ways for students to connect to the larger community. Because if you stay on the campus, you're fairly isolated and you don't get to put your education into any kind of context. So there are biannual career fairs, and it'd be wonderful if more of the African-American alumni would come back and participate.
Brenda, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm in a unique position because I'm dean of admissions for the medical school at Duke, and I am an academic advisor for undergraduate students at Duke as well. And so it's difficult, but I've tried to make myself available and for mentoring students, for helping them get through Duke, not just for the academic piece, but how you negotiate the politics of Duke and the sociology of Duke. I hope that Duke will take the opportunity to use its African-American students in a way to help this process of coming together and recognizing the differences and celebrating them, but also talking about how those differences can actually inform a new conversation about global diversity. And that has not happened yet. We have lots of global health and global stuff going on, but we still have a lot of self-segregation on Duke's campus. And the fires that got us going are still smoldering at Duke.
Well, Nat, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I just think that the one thing that happened to me, because I've been in Durham a good bit over the last year for other reasons, I was at the BU Cafe, which is actually owned by a black Dukie, and there were two parents, a young lady and a young man there, and it turned out that the young man was coming for an early admissions program to Duke, and I had sort of adopted him in a way in mentoring, and I haven't had as much time with him, but I found another graduate closer in time to him who I thought would really be able to help him because he could tell him something that was more related to what his reality was going to be. But I just think that connection, the reconnection to the school and the students and the community can help a lot.
John Thielen, I want to switch gears a little bit and again take us back to the time at which Duke is beginning the integration process in all the schools in the Southeast. In the early Southern universities, I think in the 60s and early 70s, there's the question of athletes and athletics. Did athletics play any part in integration? Sort of which came first?
The irony is that I think in American society, we often look to sports to be on the vanguard, and you know, like claims such as the level playing field, but with intercollegiate athletics, they actually lag behind. And if I can connect to some of the comments that the alums made earlier about isolation, I think that held not only for many student activities, but in particular for varsity sports. And I believe that in the Atlantic Coast Conference and in the Southeast Conference and the Southwest Conference, that there would be quite a bit of resistance to allowing African-American students to be full-fledged varsity athletes.
Well, that's interesting that that was actually lagged behind. And you know that the concern was initially going in that there would be that academic standards would somehow suffer with integration. And then there's people like Terry Sanford who realized the state of North Carolina was going nowhere in the modern world if it didn't integrate as a state and if it didn't become more progressive in its outlook. And that was true for its universities. Did Duke, I mean, what would Duke be? I don't know which way to ask this, John, but what was the impact on a university like Duke, which is a far different place today in its standing in the National Academy than it was in 1963? How much did integration play a part in Duke's rise to its position today?
I think it would be difficult to imagine any university having kind of full citizenship in the circle of your most esteemed universities without access and diversity. So I think that once again, it's kind of ironic in that exclusion, which was originally intended to raise academic standards, it was access that has enhanced not only in terms of diversity, but also just general levels of academic achievement. So I think that's been a good legacy.
Maureen Cullins, you are now Director of Multicultural Researches Resources at the Medical Center. You're back. You're working at Duke. Was it difficult for you to come back, given your experience there?
Well, I've been there 25 years now. And no, it wasn't difficult to come back. It was difficult to see that there were things that hadn't changed. So when I first went to Duke, I was in student affairs. So had much more contact with the undergraduates than I do now. And some of the same issues were roiling around the campus that were there when I graduated. And so I'd been gone 11 years when I returned. So it was interesting to, and sad in a way, to hear those from the students.
What are those issues?
Goodness. Some of the same ones. Disproportionate number of accusations of academic dishonesty, lower expectations in the classroom, not feeling welcome in some of the larger venues, looking for sort of a space of your own.
Still going on today?
Still going. Yes, some of that is still going today. Yeah. I don't know about the judicial statistics anymore. I've been in the School of Medicine 12 years now, so I don't know the undergraduate.
So there's work that needs to be done.
Oh, there's plenty of work that needs to be done.
Brenda,
absolutely.
Yeah, so give us an idea. What needs to be done still?
Well, I think the profile of student who comes to Duke at this point is fairly lopsided. Mm-hmm. They're relatively well-trained out of private schools. You will not see the demographic from inner city schools very much at Duke, and that's a chasm that needs to be completely taken out of the picture, because there's a reality when you have a group of very gifted, very talented, but having had no real contact with the way that many African Americans and Latinos actually live, you come out of that experience into the real world thinking that that's the way that the world is. It is not. And to be able to make that leap, Duke has to change its internal demographics and reach out to those kids who are coming with a different socioeconomic background.
Nat White, what needs to be done?
Well, I tell you, one of the things, you know, as they were talking about celebrating the 50 years of black presence at Duke, and I was actually a little reluctant about it in the sense that we were, if you just take the state of North Carolina as an example, the top schools in North Carolina, Duke was among the last to integrate. But one of the things that people talked about was it really took having that happen to catapult Duke from a regional school that celebrated Dixie during its sporting events, which sort of stopped because those of us who were there and some of the northern students who joined us just refused to join into the revelry of I wish I were in the land of cotton. Right. So it catapulted Duke to a national school that is now enabling it to be think of itself as a world-class institution with a campus under construction in China. And so but it takes us back to what are the other things that are missing that will even elevate it more and connect it to a community. And I should say about Terry Sanford, who I got to know when I was back in Durham in the 80s.
And you know I've only got about 20 seconds left. I'm sorry, Nat, but quickly.
Connection of the community to the school is pivotal in all of that.
I want to thank all of you, and I know this conversation is going to continue throughout the year. Nat White, Jr., class of 67, Dr. Brenda Armstrong, class of 70, Maureen Cullins, class of 76, John Thielen, professor of education, author of A History of American Higher Education. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.